not of like, this isn't like a retirement tour. Whereas, you know, other people who have kind of started dabbling in gravel were kind of like, you know, winding it down, just kind of being a promotional face and, you know, going on a fun tour. And I mean, I'm kind of in the prime of my career physically.
Hey folks, welcome to the Adventure Sports Podcast. My name's Mason. I host this show, and you might notice we weren't doing Thursday episodes for a couple weeks, and that was because we were going to just try out doing one episode a week. And yeah, the consensus was y'all really like Thursday episodes, so we're going to start them back up with the new year. So this is the first Thursday of the year, of course, and we're going to be picking it back up. And these are, you know, replay, you know, revisited episodes from the past, as well as, you know, some bonus episodes. And today's episode is actually an interview from the other show I host called Without Compromise, where we talk to people in the community of my day job, which is Athletic Brewing. There's a lot of crossover there with Adventure Sports Podcast, so that explains that. And today we're talking to Pete Stetna. He's a former pro road cyclist, you know, raced in events like the Tour de France, the World Tour, all those events that are much more popular in Europe. But he was on an American team, did really well. You know, you might recognize his name. He's a very famous cyclist. But he made this really unprecedented move last year, which was to leave road racing and go into gravel racing, which is pretty crazy in the world of cycling, because gravel is kind of unproven. It's a lot more, as you'll hear from his story, a lot more fun, a lot less, you know, seems like it's a lot less serious on the outside, but as Pete will tell you, that's not true when you're racing. There is you know, just more fun. People are having more fun, is what Pete's saying. So really cool idea. Definitely stepping out on a limb, but unfortunately his first year gravel racing was 2020, and we all know it happened to events, so he is still yet to really get out there and do stuff. But he's making a name for himself in the gravel world, and it's been pretty cool to watch. And we at Athletic Brewing have been really, really excited to be a part of what he's doing and just be involved. And if you don't know Athletic Brewing, we make non-alcoholic craft beer. You know, we love craft beer, but you can't always drink alcohol. So for the 90% of situations in my life where a beer doesn't make sense, it's nice to have that taste of craft beer, but not the effect of alcohol for whatever reason. And if you'd like to give it a shot, just use the code ADVENTURE. At athleticbrewing.com. I think that'll get you 15% off. I believe that code's still active. I'll check in the morning. But all this to say, it's good to be back. We're back on Thursdays. We're back on Mondays, two episodes a week. It seems like from Monday's episode, there were just crazy amounts of downloads. It was like a really big day. And so I think there's a hunger this year to do something. I know personally, there's a hunger in me to do more adventures, to do more micro adventures, which we're big proponents of. And so I think a lot of y'all are going to be listening to shows like this to get essentially inspiration and ideas. And so we're going to try to be feeding that hunger, that very positive hunger in your life. So without further ado, here is Pete Stetna. Stetna. Is it Stetna or Stetina? I heard it pronounced both ways, actually.
It is Stetna. My ancestors come from Czechoslovakia, and then all the Italians racing in Europe would think it's Stetina. So yeah, everyone says it that way, but it's Stetna with a silent I.
Man, you know what I think it was? I think it was actually Italian saying it, Stetina. So that's so funny when in my research. But anyway, Pete, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So you know, we talked a little bit before, but you're coming from the Tahoe area. Is that home for you, or where do you consider home?
That's an ongoing conversation. Technically, the primary residence is Santa Rosa, wine country, California, Sonoma County, just north of San Francisco. Great all-season riding, vineyards, foodie, wino, craft beer paradise. But I also have a little cabin in Tahoe where I spend most of my warm or most of the summer fall months preparing for the biggest races. And that's my happy spot. So a lot of people think I am full-time in Tahoe, but I'm not really a full-time resident in either. It's yeah.
Looking forward to the constant change a little bit.
I think so. And I just growing up racing every weekend all over the world, it's, you know, I definitely have some wanderlust built into my lifestyle and soul. So I get a little antsy if I'm somewhere too long. I got to change it up with fresh scenery and different rides. So
you mentioned childhood. Where did you grow up? And, you know, it sounds like you got into cycling pretty young. What was kind of, you know, what kind of family did you grow up in? Super active or did you find it kind of on your own?
Yeah, I grew up in Boulder, Colorado. So outdoor sports mecca, you know, and a kid growing up in this idyllic outdoor community, health focused, hippie yuppie society. My dad was actually a famous American bike racer back in the 70s and early 80s. So, it was kind of in my blood, I guess. But, you know, I became that classic talent pipeline development, you know, just picked up. I already had kind of a name attached to me, even before I started riding. But, I found it on my own. You know, my parents never pushed me into the sport. I actually found it through, you know, a soccer buddy. We were soccer teammates and he was into mountain bike racing. And I joined the local YMCA team. And our first big race was this 24 hours of Moab relay race where you trade off laps with five kids or pros or whoever, you know, throughout the night. 24 hour racing used to be a lot bigger. So that was kind of my first foray. And then once I found the sport and was like, oh my gosh, I like this. And I'm pretty good at this. Then my family, you know, had that background to really support me.
How soon was your talent like apparent? Was it right away or did you grow into that as well?
I think it was always pretty evident I was going to be an athlete. You know, I talked to my mom and stuff and she was like, you know, as a kid, like I had so much energy. She was like, she would just tell, like, bring me outside and say, like, I'm going to time you to run around the house, you know, as fast as you can. And I would do a lap and she'd be like, nope, that wasn't good enough. And I just keep doing it until I was tired. So I think I was a runner first before I found cycling. I tried every sport pretty bad with hand-eye coordination, ball handling skills. But
so no basketball.
I tried. I loved it. I remember growing up watching like the Jordan Pippen, Rodman, Reign of the Bulls and stuff. And yeah, but once I found cycling, I was invested very fast. Loved it. So
yeah, not a lot of basketball proteges coming out of Boulder, but cycling now, yeah. On the other hand.
Exactly.
Definitely. So from there, were you, what was the kind of climbing through the ranks like for you? Was it, Boulder is by no means a small pond. I'm sure not even back then. So
right.
if you were doing well there, you're probably pretty clear you could take that talent somewhere bigger.
Yeah. You know, and Boulder was unique. I have a very different version of Boulder in my head than many, because a lot of people move there to be an elite athlete, right? And they just get ingrained with that community immediately. Whereas, you know, I grew up with my high school friends and, you know, just kind of was the sport side of Boulder was kind of just on the side. But, you know, it was pretty plug and play pretty fast. You know, there was so many pros living in Boulder that, you know, I was immediately picked up by Jonathan Botter's junior team, right? And so for anyone who follows Pro Tours Road Cycling, the current EF Pro Cycling team in the Tour de France and all that started as this little junior amateur team in Front Range of Colorado in, I want to say it was like 2003, you know, and every year it kind of grew. And so I was like one of the original Colorado members. And basically every year they kind of made a step up, got bigger sponsors, signed bigger names. I was just good enough to kind of make the cut. So I was very much a grassroots development project of the Slipstream organization, which is the founding company of the EF team. You know, it was just kind of, I stayed with them. And then, you know, I started getting invited by Team USA to do events in Europe on the side. And just slowly, you know, reached a higher level. You graduate out of juniors, you go into the under 23 ranks. And then after you age out of under 23s, I was good enough to sign, you know, the Pro Tour contract for again, those who don't follow cycling, the Pro Tour is kind of like the major leagues of cycling, right? So the Pro Tour is the biggest races in the world, like the Tour de France and that stuff. And there's 18 teams in that tier. And so I kind of graduated into there in 2010 when I was out of my under 23 season. So I guess 24.
What was the experience of riding on those pro teams? Like, that had to feel just crazy, like being at the top of kind of the talent pool that early on. And I felt like it was big then. I was watching the Tour de Vie or like the Tour de France around 2010 when I first started getting interested. And it just seemed like it was growing so quickly in popularity.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I was definitely part of that generation with the juniors that came out of watching Lance Armstrong. You know, because cycling just boomed so hard during the Lance era, you know, as, along with Tyler Hamilton, Levi Leifheimer, a whole host of, you know, there's this, you know, take away the whole dark side of the cycling and doping issue, right? But there was like this decade era of just like Americans at the top of the sport, right? And, you know, so as a junior growing up in that, like, you have all these idols to look up to. So cycling really exploded that time. And then, you know, with Lance retiring, it kind of became, the American media was like, oh my God, who's our next Lance? You know, I never had quite that amount of pressure. You know, there was another rider by the name of TJ who had a lot more pressure than I did to actually be the next American Lance. But, you know, it was kind of this whole, we kind of had like this graduating class of guys who were born in the late 80s, you know, from 86 to 89, who were all quite competitive on the world stage from a very young age. And USA Cycling had like this influx from the Lance era to invest in our development too. So it was just kind of all the whole right time, right place type of thing. And then, you know, as personally, you know, you made it, you know, when you sign that pro contract and you're on one of those big teams, I mean, that's validation, right? You know, that's your stamp of approval, which was huge, you know, and that's the dream that you sacrificed everything for and sacrificed an education and all that. So I did that game for a decade. Wouldn't trade it for anything. It's hard. It's cutthroat. It's lonely, you know, living out of a suitcase in Europe by yourself a lot of the time, missing family graduations and all that and vacations. And, you know, at the same time, it's worth it. And, you know, I did a bunch of world championships, a bunch of grand tours, Tour de France's, all that. It was awesome. But then I moved on and met you guys.
Well, tell us, man, like what was, you mentioned, you know, it was something you wouldn't trade, but also very lonely, very challenging. I mean, how competitive did you have to be?
Right. You know, pro cycling is a 24/7 job for 11 months of the year. You know, you have your one off season after the last race where basically you check out for a month, you do home projects, you drink as much beer as you can fit in the system. And, you step on the scale 31 days later and you say, oh crap, like here, you know, nose to the grindstone. But then the rest of the year, I mean, it's when your body's your job, you can't really do the whole, you know, 9-to-5 thing. Like, you really just have to, I mean, everything you eat the night before counts towards the next day's training, you know, and stretching after the ride, you know, so you always just have to be fully invested in your body, you know, which is, it's hard, you know, it's hard to not, you know, take it, you want to take your foot off the gas, but then someone else is pushing just as hard. And the sport of cycling being so international, right? Like, it's all you need is a bike and to prove yourself in a race, and you can start to be noticed, especially in Europe, you know, so it's, being a global sport like that, I mean, there's not many other sports where, you know, some kid from the farm in Lithuania can compete from, you know, some kid in the Boulder Mecca of Colorado, you know, and it's, everyone can kind of prove themselves. And if you get noticed, you get a chance. So it's, there's a lot of people with a lot of hunger out there. So you know, it's very true in cycling that you're kind of only as good as your last race. And it's a pretty cutthroat lifestyle, you know, and if you do sacrifice, you know, I mean, I didn't go to my sister's college graduation, in Bellingham, you know, because, you know, I had to, even though I wasn't at a race, you know, I had to be in Europe to not be dealing with jet lag to be ready for the race a week later. And, you know, that's, it's hard to miss a lot of those things. But at the same time, like, you know, your family and all that, and they realize, like, you know, you're pursuing this dream. And, you know, when you finally make the Tour de France roster or something, you know, it's exciting for everybody. But it's a very, for me, it's a very selfish lifestyle. It encompasses so many aspects of your life, even to the time of season that, you know, we have to plan our wedding, for example. You know, like, it has to be in the off season when you can let loose and have a good time. So it's like all the cyclists are married between like mid-September and mid-November or something.
So,
you know,
like the same anniversaries.
Oh, we all do. Yeah. And it's just like, so it's, you have to sacrifice everything. And that's hard. And it was, like I said, it was so worth it. But eventually, like, I kind of saw this gravel movement where I could have a life and still be an elite athlete and still get paid to be a bike racer. So that was kind of what led to the transition a little bit too.
Yeah, I could imagine. You know, and it's interesting you mentioned it is a selfish lifestyle. I meet so many athletes that they're not selfish people, but in order to compete at that level, you have to spend so much time thinking about yourself and talking about yourself. And at a certain point, I can imagine it's like, I'm just tired of thinking about myself all the time.
It's true. And you start to feel guilty about certain things eventually. Some guys don't, you know, some guys are just happy to do that. And, you know, it's I think very traditional, especially in the Euro sense. You know, a lot of guys, like, you know, they move out of mom's house, you know, and they're racing, and then they immediately meet their girlfriend, future wife, and the girlfriend basically moves in and starts cooking them dinner and doing everything to prepare for their training and their training camps and their race schedule. Which is fine, but it takes that dedication, because at the same time you're already sacrificing so much. It's like, you can't succeed in any sport really at that top end if you are only 99% invested, you know. And that's why I didn't pursue, you know, higher education too. I, you know, in my early under 23 years, I was in college as a freshman and racing full time in Europe. And it just, you kind of realize, like, you can only do both at 80%, 90%. And if you're really already like suffering that much, like, you just have to go all in and see where you can go. And at least if it doesn't work out, you know, you gave it everything. But, you know, when something's so hard and such a dream, like any pro sport, I think you have to ride it out. So even if it doesn't work out, there's no regrets. And if it does work, then, you know, that's a dream. So
you have that ability, you got to go for it. Like, it's just,
yeah,
you had this incredible experience and did so many incredible things. And then you transitioned to gravel. And I know an injury was kind of a conduit for that for you. And I don't want to dwell too much on that, because I know you've told that story 1,000 times. But
yeah,
you made an incredible recovery after what looked like some pretty dark times. What was it like to get back on the bike? And tell us about that decision to transition into the gravel world.
Yeah, you know, it was, again, just like I kind of talked about, you know, being that junior in the Lance era. It was just, again, it was just this coincidental right time, right place, and just seeing that opportunity and taking it. And it was, yeah, it wasn't like, you know, I was disillusioned and not fulfilling, you know, any athletic potential. I mean, I did the World Tour for a decade on all the biggest teams. And you know, as far as I was really concerned, like, I had kind of ticked a lot of the boxes. I mean, of course, there's a few regrets, you know, but I had my dreams in gravel outweighed my unchecked list in the World Tour, which is why I made that decision. But kind of what happened, especially last year, was this whole new discipline of cycling that was US based and fostered, of just this experience of off-road, hard endurance, getting out there in the nothingness, highlighted by this massive party and kind of that marathon style format where you have pros and age groupers all together, has really exploded. And it is the most popular segment of cycling in the US now at the moment. And I kind of dabbled in a few of the races last season while still holding my pro tour contract. And it was just this moment of enlightenment where I was like, oh my gosh, like, this is so big. I think I could actually make like a full-time go of this and still like continue to be competitive, but kind of do it on my own terms and have a lot more fun doing it. So I kind of jumped off the circus of the world tour and started my own, you know, privateer project in being a quote unquote gravel pro, even if that is a thing, but I'm trying to make it a thing.
What are some things that are immediately you notice different about racing in these events versus kind of the culture of road racing?
You know, it's still very much, it's a party and a community experience first and foremost before it's a race. And it's also, it's gentlemen's racing. So, you know, it's kind of, the result is not the end all and be all. It's the story and that shared experience, which is powerful. And most people are signing up for these things just because it's daunting to finish it. That said, whenever you give somebody a number plate, like, they're going to try harder. Like, it's still a freaking bike race, you know? And so, so there's guys at the front really racing it, but then there's thousands of people doing it for their PR or their personal best. And at the end, like, you're like, oh my gosh, we all did our own journey, but we all did it together, you know? So it doesn't really matter, you know, if I did this event in 6 hours and you did it in 7 or 8 hours, like, we went through the same things, and to celebrate that together afterwards is really powerful. And then in terms of being a pro doing it, you know, you can kind of use your influence, because people are nervous enough about even finishing these things, you know? So if there's a certain product, like a tire, that I can highlight saying, you know, like, this is giving me the best chance for success, you know, I think people, you know, I have a platform to really speak to that, that people will listen to. So, you know, that's the pro template. But at the same time, you can't sacrifice being that placings before all else, instead of, you know, people in gravel want to see a person who races bikes. I don't think they want to see a bike racer who's just a person on the side and kind of like, you know, you gotta be a personality and fun and, you know, and focus on the big picture a bit more. So
you and I were talking about that on that Coast to Coast ride, about it being more to grow the sport. You need people that are racing, that are gregarious, that are friendly, that are going to be inviting towards the sport, versus, you know, there's a lot of sports out there that it can feel extremely intimidating to approach somebody, to talk to them, or to even visit the race. You don't feel like you're doing something right, even as a spectator. But with gravel, it does seem more community oriented. And I think that's going to be a benefit in the long run for you.
I hope so. I think so. You know, and I'm having a lot more fun doing it. You know, there's going to be certain days when I'm, you know, riding in on a flat tire with, you know, hours behind the winner. And it's going to be just as important to hang out and enjoy the scene and share the stories. And the good thing about beer that's at the finish of all these events is it's good for celebrating and it's good for commiserating. So, you know, I'm going to crack one anyway, and, you know, and look forward to the next project and the next event and the next gathering of the tribe.
What kind of feedback did you get? What did you hear from folks making the transition? Was there anyone that was just dumbfounded by it, or was there a lot of support? How was it for you?
It definitely struck a chord in the cycling world. I was surprised. You know, it was very deliberate on kind of holding my cards close to my chest until I had some backers, you know, to support my adventure. But pretty quickly, the industry saw it, and then once the news dropped, I mean, a lot of people were pretty surprised, just because, you know, I'm not of like, this isn't like a retirement tour. Whereas, you know, other people who have kind of started dabbling in gravel were kind of like, you know, winding it down, just kind of being a promotional face and, you know, going on a fun tour. And I mean, I'm kind of in the prime of my career physically. So, it was very much like a jumping ship kind of feeling. And I think it struck a lot of chord, just because, you know, my story, which is true, is like, this is something I love more, and I'm striking out on my own for something that speaks true to my heart, even, you know, though it's stepping away from the limelight and the TV stuff and all that. And, you know, I think a lot of people, I mean, it's just like any industry, you know, it's, you know, instead of being an employee, you're starting your own business and, you know, trying to follow your dream. And that was just cycling's version of that. So it was overwhelmingly supportive. I definitely think cycling in Europe on the road is so traditional I mean, I've had team managers that say you can't have a beard, you can't have long hair, you can't have an ear piercing. Like, it doesn't look right. It's not professional, right? So cycling is so traditional that I think there are some of my colleagues are very interested, and some are like, oh, Pete's just winding it out. Like, he's just playing bikes now. He's not a true pro. But I mean, I can look at my fitness levels and my power files and tell you that's not the case.
You talking about that sounds so much like the journey here at Athletic. What's more traditional than beer, you know?
Right.
And it's like, it's been thousands of years. So when you diverge off the path to do something really out of the box, but essentially parallel, it's just, you get all kinds of reactions, and it's like, who would do that? And then
right.
you're shining a light on this path that you can't see where it goes. And it's like, it's in your court. You've got to make these connections. You got to manage a lot more. You said like running your own business. I know for you, it's this whole new path, and it has to feel scary, exciting, all of the above.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's the hustle is real. It's a lot of work. It's a much more whole athlete, a whole person focus. You know, it's, you know, obligations to different sponsors, whether it's Athletic or Canyon Bikes or Shimano Components, and, you know, or it's doing my own logistics, my own budgeting around that. Whereas as a pro athlete, you know, you're literally just handed a bike and you just focus on your fitness and your body, and everything else is taken care of, you know, so you can just focus on that, it's nice, but it's a very singular and simple pursuit. But yeah, you know, it's, the story is eerily similar, which is kind of fun, you know, and you realize that starting your own brand, right, is, you know, what do you stand for and what is your angle, you know, and you really have to think about that for who you align yourself with and who you want to, you know, have, you know, at your back and share your story, you know, and you know, like the Athletic story was really coincidentally interesting, you know, because it was kind of the same time, you know, you guys have really exploded in the last year. And it's just, you know, it is that same story of stepping out of the box, like screw tradition, like this makes sense. Like there's something here and we got to take it with both hands, you know? So that was a great story, you know? And the funny thing enough is, you know, like when I made this move, you know, like being a relatively well-known American cyclist in the pro world, like, you know, the industry sponsors were not difficult. You know, I actually got a lot of calls, but I pursued you. Like I wanted you guys before you knew who I was. So I read about you guys in a magazine article, and I was up here in Tahoe training for the Vuelta a España, which is the Tour de France version of Spain, right? 3 weeks long and all that. And you know, your weight and your health and all that matters so much. But you know, I'm definitely a beer geek, you know, and it's not always the best blend with your fitness. So I ordered a case of your stuff last year, and I was like, oh my God, I can finish my training ride. I go down to the lake and I crack a beer on the lake like everybody else enjoying their summer vacation. But you know, I'm still like keeping my weight in check, which is so important and all that. And you know, so that was my introduction to it. And then I'm really glad that we got to align this year. It's been a lot of fun. And now I get a lot of Athletic beer in my fridge.
It's so cool, man. The you know, even Bill's story, the founder, you know, career in finance, very traditional, very stable.
Oh, yeah.
Just kind of like, here's what you do and here's how you make money. And it's like stepping away from all that. It's, you know, it's terrifying, but it's a blank canvas for you in a lot of ways, which can be daunting some days. But I'm sure other days you're pumped more than you could ever imagine.
Yeah, you need the courage is step one. And I think the sweat equity is step two. You know, it takes a lot of work to make a splash, you know. But no, it's been a great journey. And it's actually paid off a lot, especially, you know, with the pandemic year. You know, I miss events and the gathering of my tribe more than anyone. But at the same time, it was a really nice year to be able to talk with you guys and my other sponsors and pivot to alternative concepts and events in lieu of, whereas traditional racing was just a hard governmental strict lockdown. Like, you're a pro bike racer, there's no pro bike racing, you know? And whereas we could like, oh, I'm going to, you know, meet up with you guys and tell you ride in the mountains, and we're going to like ride and take pictures on some really scenic stuff. And then I'm going to go try for, you know, a fast thing on some course in the Colorado mountains or whatever. So it was, it was hard to reinvent myself twice, once with gravel and then immediately after with no racing. What am I going to do? But at the same time, like, it allowed for a lot of creativity, which was, I think it was a silver lining.
Yeah, this is not the first time you've had to look at something that could be devastating as a silver lining. You know, your knee was probably the first big lesson in that. It's not what it seems necessarily. We hear these kind of stories over and over again of coming back from recovery, but it's almost like you just don't know it until you go through it yourself.
Yeah. You know, well, so those who don't know, I just shattered my knee and my leg in a really bad crash in Europe in 2015. I mean, it was exploded kneecap, cracked tibia, 5 ribs, LCL, critical condition in the Spanish hospital for a few weeks, a whole nother hour-long podcast on the actual story of getting back to America. but it was, a lot of people wrote my career off. You know, a doctor said, if the bone doesn't heal right, we're going to amputate it. And it was kind of like this whole, I had to relearn to walk. But I was on a contract year. So I kind of had my back against the wall to prove that I deserved to be a pro athlete. So, it was definitely a tough time and a lot of some introspection and some thinking of what's next besides sport. I saved my career, re-signed with Trek at that point, and spent 4 more years in the World Tour. So that was the story. And, there's documentaries on it if anyone actually wants to. Yeah.
I was going to say that. Hey, there's been some incredible, covering of that story, and I'm going to push people to listen, and it's hugely inspiring. If that doesn't prove you've got what it takes to make whatever you want to do happen, I don't know what will, man. You got what it takes. That's incredible. Man. That's incredible.
I personally value that recovery as my biggest victory in my career. You know, I answer a lot of questions of, what was your biggest result? And, it wasn't a win. Like, that was the biggest struggle and fight personally, of physically, I would say, and sometimes mentally. But, that was what I'm most proud of for me in my career, and showing that I could come back. And then looking forward, I would really actually love to just redo my 2020 calendar, because most of the big gravel events didn't get to happen, and I'm pretty optimistic in just that. If the vaccine stuff is legit and it corrects all, and hopefully we can just be back to those 4,000 person events that we all love, and rock concerts and all that. So I would love to just get to do my initial jump to gravel that I didn't even get to do. So that's plan A, but you always need a plan B right now. So should things lock down again, I have a bunch of other alt projects coming out. A silver lining this year was finding the public interest and my personal love of FKTs, meaning fastest known times on certain course records, very solo and almost spiritual efforts in the middle of nowhere on famous routes. So there'll be more of that regardless. I think events are going to happen, marathons, bike events in the summer, in the warm months when you can gather outside. There was an event that got the green light late October, and it was a 600 person event. I was very nervous about attending, but I wanted to support the organizer because they really put their necks out there, and they had a pretty robust and thoughtful COVID mitigation strategy. And there have been 0 reported cases from that event in October. So I think at the worst case scenario, if things are like they were this summer, when we didn't understand a lot about this whole this pandemic, then I think things can happen in the warmest months of the year. So that gives me some hope.
I totally agree. We're going to find a way to make events uncancelable. Man, Pete, man, you just shared so many cool things. You talked about your FKTs. I saw you did this thing about funnest known times. And I remember when I saw this and we were getting ready for the coast to coast trip, I was like, I'm going to get along with this guy. talking about having fun more than anything and focusing on that in a year like this, that's a hell of a good attitude right there. So I was like, Pete and I are going to be friends, I think. That was cool.
Maybe you guys can help me with a route out east or something, but the fastest known time is not always the funnest. I mean, your funnest bike rides are going hard sometimes and going for a PR on a certain hill, but there's also, there's swimming holes and there's amazing bakeries with this crazy flavored muffin and all these other things that make the adventure so worth it, right? So, you know, I'm kind of working with a few sponsors to set up routes in near major populated areas with the hashtag of the funnest known time. And we kind of establish a route and teach you those tips and tricks to just have a great day out there in that area. That's like, this is a killer ride. Here's the GPS. Here's the nuances and the things to look for, whether it's a camel in the mountains of Colorado or a swimming hole in deep in Marin County or something. So that's been a lot of fun.
That's awesome. Well, dude, let's jump into rapid fire. I know we've kind of gone over time, and but I would love to ask, you don't have to answer these one word, just kind of a sentence or two.
Right on.
Cool. All right. Rapid fire number one. Do you have a life motto or a motto that you're kind of currently living out?
Yeah. A happy racer is a fast racer. You know, it's, I think you can look back at our whole conversation and see why I've chosen that.
You jumped on that, man. You knew that.
Yep.
Was okay. That's in the front of your mind then. Dang, that's
been
awesome.
A lot of pivoting this year.
Yeah, no kidding. You got that in your van somewhere on the ceiling.
Maybe that's a tattoo. Yeah.
Okay, there you go. Right on the knuckles. What are you most curious about right now outside of racing?
I craft beer, actually. You know, I that was another reason that we joined forces was I am very much a beer geek and a beer snob at this point, which is not all, for a lot of pro athletes out there. But I love traveling to different towns and visiting the local tap house and getting a flight or something and exploring the world of craft beer. That's probably my second favorite passion.
Wow, I didn't realize it was that high on your list. That's cool to hear. So yeah, we're like a cheat code for you then, because
exactly
your two passions kind of work against each other sometimes. But
I know, exactly. Yeah, you're doing the math now, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm thinking, all right, you know, he's it's literally working against each other, but that's cool. It keeps you sharp. So you answered this. Proudest achievement is you know, recovering from that knee surgery. What would you say the proudest achievement is, maybe outside of your career altogether?
It's a hard one. You know, just outside of my career, I've been so focused on the world tour, honestly. Like, you have to live a singular life for so long. You know, just family, you know, meeting my wife early and you know, marrying her early and getting stronger through this pandemic. And, you know, we've got, you know, I'm relatively young and I got, you know, a cabin in Tahoe, which is a dream. So it's a good lifestyle right now.
I love to hear when folks are in a good spot.
I mean, I think all my other achievements are through cycling related, right? Like, I work with, you know, a charity that supports injured athletes, but I can do that because of, you know, my position within the cycling community. And so it's, you know, it's hard to differentiate the two because, like I said before, your job is your lifestyle in cycling.
No, I think that's a good answer. You know, it's different for everybody. So tell me this then, what's your biggest goal not yet achieved?
Oof.
Yeah, just very small little questions here.
I know, we're getting real philosophic right now. You know, I would love to, this year specifically, my biggest professional goal is to, you know, actually stand on the top step in some of the biggest gravel races. But even more importantly, just help continue to make gravel a very legitimate discipline within cycling. And that includes beyond personal race results. That's continuing to make a living, being my own boss and my own brand, and foster diversity in cycling, whether through people of a different racial background or women's parity in sport. You know, so I got a couple irons in the fire in that regard.
Awesome. All right, last question, and kind of wrap it all up. How do you live without compromise?
I think I compromise a lot on a lot of things, whether it's an interval or it's a beer that I shouldn't have. You know, there's another motto. It's not a motto. It's a good way to live, though. You got to be at 90%, 90% of the time, you know? And so I think there is always room for a compromise, but as long as you're 90% at your top, you know, you're always there, you're always professional, whatever it is in life, whether it's your relationship, it's your your race goals. It's, you know, it's your training, it's your job. If you're at 90%, there's always, you know, there's 10% of the time you can step it up to like that ultimate peak, right, for that biggest goal. And then, you know, a couple percent of the time you can drop it down and have a great night out with friends and regret it the next day too. Like there's got to be room for that flux, right? But if you can kind of keep your baseline at 90%, I think you do pretty well. So actually, I live with a lot of compromises.
Yeah, you know, there is a healthy side of compromise, and I guess the one we talk about is, you know, the negative side. Like we've all got to make decisions that we come to an agreement somewhere. Well, Pete, man, thanks for joining us. This was great. I feel like it could be a 5-hour interview with just your whole story and everything you've gone through and what you're doing now. It's so interesting.
Thanks, guys. Happy to be on, and I'm waiting for that call when you ask me to make a collaboration beer. I'm ready. I'm self-plugging that one.
All right. We start sending some emails. I have no say in that, but I know who does. But
there we go.
Well, cool. Well, Pete, man, thank you so much. I hope you have a great day, and we'll talk soon.
Sounds good. See you.
All right. See you. First of all, thank you so much for listening. It means the world to us that you choose to listen to this show. If you'd like to help us further, you can leave a review on iTunes, share us with your friends, your family. It goes a long way to grow in the show. You can also support us financially through patreon.com/adventuresportspodcast. Link is in the show notes. And also, if you have an idea of who could be a good guest for the show, we're always looking for people to tell their story about the outdoors or adventure. So if you know someone, please reach out. Email us at info@adventuresportspodcast.com. And until then, get out there and have some fun.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.